and to chat.
Well, we will.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week, we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, January 15th, 2010, I'm delighted to welcome Shel Israel, author of Twitterville, How Businesses Can Thrive in the New Global Neighborhoods. Welcome, Shel.
Hi, Janet. Good to be here.
So glad to have you on. I'm sorry we didn't get to really chat much beforehand, but I feel like everybody knows who you are. You're kind of like the guest that breaks through the noise of the internet, and people recognize your name, and largely because you've been doing this for quite some time. I think in your own bio you say 25 years, right?
Well, not the internet part, but
communications.
I've been involved in Silicon Valley and communications since 1979. Before that, I was a newspaper guy for 12 years. So if nothing else, I'm a senior citizen in the community we're in now.
Well, I think that you earn respect, though, too. So that's a nice thing. I want to talk a little bit about, obviously, your book, Twitterville. It came out on September 3rd. And I'm curious, you did sort of the book tour, and I got the chance to see you speak at an SCNR event. And I'm just wondering kind of what the question that you were asked most by sort of more general citizens that were coming to your book events, what seemed to be a common thread?
There's a list of questions that anybody who talks about social media hears a lot. With Twitterville, there's the famous ROI question. I get asked a lot why I called it Twitterville. I get asked a question that I can't answer, which is, what's my favorite story in the book? Partly I can't answer that, although there's a couple that jump out at me, because what I like about Twitterville is the collection of stories shows the breadth and depth of Twitterville, which answers another one of those frequently asked questions of, how can you say anything in 140 characters?
Very much so. And I mean, one of the things that you touch on in the book is how, sometimes what you eat for lunch can be interesting.
You bet.
Even though people think,
what did you have for lunch? Oh, what time zone are you in? Have you had lunch yet?
It's Pacific, and I noshed on leftovers from last night.
So you're ahead of me. I'm sitting here realizing that I'll have about 20 minutes for lunch after we're done talking, and I thought you might have a suggestion for me. I'm sorry, you don't.
Nope, only leftovers. You can come over to my house, though, anytime.
Well, thanks. I'll do it when I have more than 20 minutes. But the point is what you had for lunch and where you had the lunch and who you had it with can sometimes be very, very relevant. I didn't get to write about Vicky Horvitz in the book, but Vicky is a guy I went to elementary school with who discovered me actually on Facebook, but we moved over to Twitter at my urging, and told me that he had just had lunch in the Depot Cafe, where I hung out as a high schooler just about when Silicon Valley was launching the wheel. So that was fascinating for me, and that rekindled a memory that was long gone. And the hometown is New Bedford, Massachusetts, which is the only place a pizza and beer joint would still be around after all those years.
Well, maybe not the only, but pretty close. One of the interesting things that you just mentioned is how that tweet, or maybe it was a collection of tweets, harkened back to something very specific and nostalgic and, evoked very personal memories for you. Yet, as you mentioned in the title of your book, it's really connecting people globally. How did you go about sort of addressing that? Because I think for people that are still out there and that maybe haven't engaged with Twitter at all, or kind of looking at the book as, you know, a collection of stories that maybe they don't feel are relevant to them. Can you kind of explain how that, how it, it you know, how this is a global phenomenon?
I could write a book about that.
Yeah.
The global neighborhood part actually predates Twitterville by a few years, and it started with coffee with a neighbor of mine, Charlene Lee, who some people I'm sure have heard of.
Oh, yeah. She'll be on the program a little bit, I think, next month.
She's the groundswell author, and she wrote the foreword to Twitterville. But prior to that, Charlene, in a conversation to me, just threw away the line that social media is making geography irrelevant, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard that thought, but that was the first time I had heard it, and it was probably 2007. And it started dawning on me that on the internet or in social media, we're reorganizing society based on shared interest. And my interests involve a curiosity about people and cultures everywhere. I've had that interest since long before there was a Twitter, but suddenly I'm finding myself talking with people on all continents, very diverse people. I was talking with some kids at Shepherd's Junior School, which is in Tanzania and is part of Twitterville. They were the recipients of money through a nonprofit effort called Tweets Giving. And there I was talking with a 10-year-old kid in Africa who's using the school computer to talk with me. And he immediately told me the things I could send him, which I thought was kind of cute, and I didn't do it. But I talk with people in China, in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in even Greece, which supposedly has almost nobody connected, in London, in Ireland, Scotland, and it goes on. And we talk about, well, we talk about Twitter. Every now and then we talk about lunch. We talk about business. I get business that way. I get invited to speak all over the world, which is really kind of cool. And people are finding others who share their interests, whether it's bidding on graphic design or on talking politics or hummers or hummingbirds or whatever you're interested in. There are others like you. And all your life, not all your life, but in the history of your ancestors, you were confined to finding people who shared your interests in your neighborhood, which was bordered by mountains and rivers and forests and enemies. And now you have neighborhoods that go everywhere, and you can live in lots of them and talk to people all over the world who share your interest. And when you do that, it changes the world because ideas and information is moving much, much faster and much more directly than it ever has before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the global neighborhoods thing. And you might tell I'm pretty passionate about it. And actually, I wanted to write a book about global neighborhoods itself, but I could only find about 35,000 words before it started getting redundant. So I folded it into Twitterville and expanded on 140-character thoughts.
I think a lot of us, you know, I mean, I was in the Peace Corps, so, you know, finding my family on Twitter, you know, that things like stories like that, I think, you know, a lot of us, whatever our personal passions are, we can kind of, you know, understand it if that's kind of our perspective. But I wanted to get your take on something that seems to have continued. It, you know, it was obviously happening, you know, at the time the book came out, but, you know, the what some call the corporatization of Twitter. So a lot of corporations hiring people to be their authentic, you know, tweeter, for lack of a better term. I'm wondering, because we're really talking about the realm of these authentic, genuine conversations, and that being very much the value of the tool. And I really want to get your take on the other aspect, which is, you know, maybe less authentic and much more commercial use of Twitter, and if you think that interferes or conflicts.
You know, all my life I've heard people say things aren't like they used to be, and they're right. And more than that, as things get better, there are always these side events which are not better. I joined Twitter when it was small. There were maybe 5 or 6 million people there. And there was this nice hometown intimacy, and it was just people. And it extended what came in the roots of blogging, a certain anti-corporate sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Twitter is like a telephone, and anybody who wishes to communicate in any voice and in any style can do that. Celebrities whose careers are on the wane can get a new turbo boost by pretending to be authentic in Twitterville, and some of them are succeeding that way. But the good news is that some of the features that Twitter has done a very good job on are the unfollow and the block button. And you can, and this is probably among the, I try to avoid these lists of this is what you should do, but one of the things that I think people really need to realize is who you follow is probably much more important than who follows you. They are your daily newspaper. They are your source of information. They're where when you tune in and you go to Twitter, that's what where you get the answer to what's new, what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one thought, and I'm going to let that lay there a while. The second thing is I talked to a lot of businesses for the book. And I heard so many comments, so many stories that began with, we came here to broadcast, we came here to send, we came here to capture eyeballs and bring them back to our website where we can sell them our stuff. And then after a little while, they realized that by just sitting back and listening and watching, they had more to gain, more to learn about what the market felt about their products and the specific conditions that matter to them by listening than they did by sending out messages. So it's sort of like going to a party where some guy is really trying to impress you with how great he is, how smart he is, how classy he is, how he has the best car. And you're ready, you're just about done with him, and suddenly he says something, and you realize, hey, there may be something inside there besides all this Teflon. And you realize, hey, he's not such a bad guy, and he on the other side is saying, hey, I think she likes me after all, and he stops trying to impress, and he starts becoming authentic. I think that happens for an awful lot of businesses. Businesses have models. They're comfortable taking a best practice. More often than not, a business comes to social media with marketing in mind and discovers that it is a marketing tool, certainly, but it isn't just a marketing tool. It's a conversational tool.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you talk about? You talk about whatever you want. And lo and behold, all those corporate types are real people too. And they really like to take off the necktie and the shiny stuff and stop talking as if we at X corporation of 55,000 people all walk and think alike. And they really often care about their jobs and the quality of the products and services they provide. And they really do want to know how they can do better. And many of them really like to apologize for having screwed up, and lawyers one at a time and one company after another are getting beat back from the risk issues of what could happen, and companies are starting to relax and just talk.
Mm-hmm.
Then the final thought on this, because I know I'm getting long-winded for a podcast, is that this is all real new, and it is going to keep changing, and there are going to be people coming in who are going to try to muck it up. And more and more people, I think, are going to discover what works there is just let real people have real conversations.
Yeah, the two-way, you know, idea of a conversation, not just this, as you said, you know, starting out with this idea that we're going to be a PR, you know, we're going to be a newswire service pushing out, but that there's actually value that comes back in. I think that's an incredibly important point.
The value to companies is what comes back in much more than what goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of companies like Dell and Comcast and SAP, who I'm writing about now, have started to really, really understand that what they listen to and respond to is much more important than what they shovel out to begin with.
Very, very good points. And we could go on and on about the business examples that you have in the book, but I want to move on to another theme that you touch on, and that is who's using Twitter in terms of professionals versus students. So, you know, you have the MySpace crowd that skews really young. Facebook might be the glorious mix of the generations. But certainly Twitter has very much a Gen X and boomer, you know, probably more Gen X, but definitely crosses many spectrums in terms of who it reaches. Talk a little bit about how that affects the communication channel in terms of its power, reach, etc.
I might have to say be a little more specific, or I could just babble a bit. What's your pick?
Well, here's the thing. So one thing that I'm starting to see on Twitter as I go through, you know, and I'm personally just really interested in sort of this generationally who uses what. And it seems that millennials, those born after 1982 roughly, are not as attuned to Twitter, but very much Generation X and up are using Twitter. And that means that,
okay,
you know, from a business perspective, obviously it makes it more relevant because of purchase power. But what does that mean for, you know, in terms of, you know, the generations to come? Is it are we going to start to see younger people use this and be empowered by it in the ways that the older generations have found it useful?
I don't have a clue, and I'll probably be dead when these younger generations come along. I do know that it is the nature of teenagers to not use whatever their parents used, and that migrating people upward, as MySpace has learned, is a strategy that probably won't work. I also think that the core cultures, the founding cultures of any kind of social media, overwhelmingly impacts how it grows. Facebook began in college, and remnants of a college culture are very much at the center of Facebook.
Mm.
Twitter began because a Web 2.0 startup trying to do a podcast and video search, company was called Odeo, not to be confused with today's Odeo, but that's another sidebar. They just wanted to figure out where their developers were so they could have meetings. And they really needed to know whether those developers were doing something more important than the meeting. And, you know, they're developers. They're Web 2.0 developers. They work in the hours they want, the places they want. And every now and then they stagger into the office. So the founders of the company held out a problem and said, we just want to know what you're doing right now so that we can call meetings. And they're not a founder at the time, but Jack Dorsey said, you know, I've been hacking around with something since I was a teenager, and it'll take me a couple of weeks to make it work the way you want it to work, but let's try it. And they did, and that became Twitter, and it was used to solve an internal problem. The company had 12 members, and at the end of day one, they had 25 users. And because they were Web 2.0, they never said, hey, this is proprietary, you can't use it. But their culture began with mobile professionals. It was designed for mobile applications, which I don't think any social media before it was designed specifically for mobile apps. It had nothing to do with a book of pretty faces for fraternity brothers at Harvard and Yale. It also wasn't used to mine data from teenagers, such as MySpace. And it just began with the concept of we're mobile professionals. And as it has grown so rapidly, it has never lost the fact that at the core of it, it was founded by mobile professionals. I believe that unlike MySpace, as people grow older, Twitter will continue to be an unprecedentedly useful tool, and the people will use it throughout their lives, like a telephone, as opposed to like MySpace. What does this mean to the marketer? Well, everything. But again, the marketer should not see Twitter, should is not a good word. If I were still a marketer, I'm a recovering marketer. I went to pitch enders. I wrote on the wall 100 times, stop me before I hype again. But if I were still a marketer, I would find Twitter very useful, but not as a marketing tool, as a communications tool. For example, marketing people spend a whole lot of money in something, or used to spend a lot of money in something, called a focus group. The first thing you need to do was assemble a small group of people who, for enough money, would pretend they didn't realize there was a TV camera behind the mirror. They had to find enough people who would not get dominated by the opinions of one person, they didn't really get information that was as useful or accurate as they thought. And it was a slow process. And not only was it a slow process, there were several communications agencies involved in every one of these, so there had to be a whole lot of analysis so you could have the billable hours involved. And now, if a company wants to know about its products, its programs, its services, its staff, its support quality, all they got to do is use the appropriate monitoring tools on social media, particularly Twitter, because Twitter is the headline monger. It's where news breaks fast, spreads furthest. It isn't very deep. It's shallow and broad. But it's where news breaks in business and in the marketplace. And any marketer today is ignoring it, I think, is making a very, very dangerous mistake.
So one of the things you mentioned, Jack Dorsey, and I'm not sure if you were able to attend Le Web in December. Were you there?
No, I was not.
So there was.
I don't get around much anymore.
Oh, you're such a liar! But so the rare conference you didn't go to, Jack Dorsey demoed Square, which is the new technology that allows for people that don't know you to use an audio jack to plug in this little Square device to swipe credit cards and take credit card payments. So marketers, you've just made a good case for marketers that aren't already engaged to get engaged and maybe for some food for thought on how they might think about using Twitter. How do you think Square, or what might be your predictions around productizing something for Twitter that is very obviously something that can generate a sale on the spot?
I think productizing and instant selling over the internet is an absolute trend and an inevitable one. I think Square is one example. What happened in the last 48 hours in Haiti is extremely interesting, where telephone companies are allowing you to text donations that are connected to your phone bill, and it goes through a third-party company. I think it's called eGive, but I could be wrong. And I have more questions than answers on this as to just where is the money going, how is it being distributed, what percentage of this money is being held by the phone companies and eGive, just what are we buying with the money we're giving. And all of that makes me worry about it. At the same time, we just found a device that billions of people, literally billions of people in the world, are comfortable with, that allow you to respond and buy something on impulse wherever you are. You can do it if you're not in the state of California, where they may incarcerate you. You can do it while talking, listening to your car radio. You can do it while watching television. You can do it in the middle of a phone conversation, anywhere you want, in a movie house. You sit down, and we go to the movies to get away from the ads on television, and now the ads have followed us into the movies. You can now pick up your cell phone before they order you to turn it off and buy something. You can be polled. You can do an instant survey. So using modern technology for sales is not inherently bad. It's extremely useful, but it is highly abusable, and we need to think about that part of it as we move forward.
I should say that I just wanted to verify who was doing the mobile donations for Haiti, and there's actually, according to Time Magazine, three. There's a company called Mobile Giving, Give on the Go, and MGive, and those organizations are said to be, they're actually waiving founding fees and other things to get money to the right places. So those would be ones to take a look at if people are wanting to donate. So that's important to know. But
they're partnering with the phone companies, and to be honest,
yes,
I have my suspicions about anything that goes through my phone company.
I totally agree, and I that's the next thing I wanted to ask you about in our last minute or two here. Is you said you're a recovering marketer. Yet Twitterville uncovers the fact, and I think, you know, even in your own bio, you talk about how many people you've interviewed. And you, to me, feel like you sit somewhere sort of almost like your books sometimes feel very Tom Wolfe-esque, and not necessarily in the writing style, but in the sense that you sit somewhere in the journalism world, but you don't really have a title yet. right? Pardon?
I said, help me.
Anyone needs a title to survive, right? But what is your sort of take on that today? That, you know, I mean, the service that you're providing is one that we would expect, you know, through the writing of your books and even doing this interview, and bringing up Haiti is one of the things, you know, that we can look at in terms of being able to help people, and then talking about, you know, maybe wanting to write about that or bringing that up as something hopefully someone will latch onto and write about. But you do tend to write about things that are and do so in a very journalistic nature. I mean, you talk about how many people that you've interviewed. So I'm just curious where you kind of bucket yourself in the sort of state of play out there, because there are other people that are like you, but I think you are definitely a trailblazer as far as that is concerned.
Well, people have called me a blazing something very often in my life. but in my heart, I'm a writer. In my heart, I'm a storyteller. I had to stay after school in second grade for telling stories, so I went into nonfiction. That got me into a dozen years as a journalist. A young woman who was in PR broke up with me because she was tired of going to lousy restaurants in a broken-up car. And I got tired of the vow of poverty, and I ended up going into PR where I did pretty well for nearly 30 years until one day I woke up and discovered, not woke up, I went into my office and discovered I had all this bubble spittle all over my nice Italian suit. And the dot-com bubble had burst, and suddenly I no longer owned an agency of 17 people. And if I was going to reassume a vow of poverty, I'd go back into writing. Trouble is, everybody was laying off journalists left and right, so I did some freelance work for Business Week and other places. But if somebody once said, hey, try this blogging thing because everybody you've written about in the past is already dead of old age, so you need to freshen up your act and get back at writing, I got into blogging and I loved it. And since then, how I make a living remains one of these mysteries that every now and then my wife points out to me. And if anybody out there is listening and they have money for someone like me, you can't text it, but you can find me on the internet. But at the heart of it, I would say I'm a journalist with one very, very critical exception. As a journalist, I had to at least pretend to be objective. And in my writing, I report to you as a journalist would, but I jump in and tell you what I think. And that's a freedom that I could not do when I worked all those years in traditional journalism.
So a journalist with an opinion.
Yeah. Hunter Thompson called it the journalism of involvement, but he was probably stoned when he said it, so I'm not
probably.
Sure.
Probably.
Yeah. But there is something about the fact that if I speak to somebody who just saw a building collapse in Haiti or attended a presidential news conference, I would want to say, well, what do you think? And if I were the Washington Post person, I would have to tell you, my job is to inform you, and what I think about is not relevant. Well, it is relevant, because you're a human being, and I respect your writing, and I think you have some credibility. I want to know what you think about it. So I feel obliged to tell people what I think. Just like in my books, there's usually somebody I totally disagree with, and I may cheat because I always get the last word, but I let them have their say so that you, the reader, can decide whether I'm right or that person's right. So it's
very key.
At the key, I am a journalist, but there are several differentiations to it. And as far as the title, I don't know what the hell I am. It's this identity problem that I have. So help me solve that one.
Well, I think that there's a lot of it. I mean, it came up for me at Le Web because Robert Scoble and Mike Arrington were very much a part of facilitating conversation.
Wait a minute. Who's this guy, Scoble?
Yeah, that Robert guy.
Yeah.
But yeah,
hey,
you
what's
know,
happening?
I went to Columbia School of Journalism, so I was there covering Le Web for this podcast, and I met up with a recently graduated journalism school student who just graduated, was very, very green, and, you know, but local. She was finishing up a joint program with Columbia in France. And so, you know, she was totally confused. She's like, so who are the journalists? Where are the Business Week people? Where, because there were so many announcements happening. And just, you know, sort of what she had read about Robert Scoble and Michael Arrington, and then, you know, seeing them on stage sort of facilitating, or almost, I don't want to say, you know, I'm trying to think of the right way to say it, but, you know, like Mike was very, you know, complimentary to Marissa Mayer of Google to kind of get her going in terms of questioning. And so for her, there was this huge blurring of lines. So I always love to ask that question for that reason, because I think that there is this sort of shift that's taken place. And I think it started from 9/11, actually, where people were actually impacted. And now we have tools like this where we see the impact on everyday people's lives.
I agree with everything you just said, and we have an urge to define and measure everything, and eventually we get there, but we are in a very transformational period. Sometimes I say things that sound too dramatic to me, but I really believe them, and one of them is social media is just about changing, is changing. It hasn't done it yet. Most institutions in the world, everything, education, healthcare, you know, it begins with a bunch of geeks in Silicon Valley, and it begins with a business model for traditional, I guess I have to say, media, not journalism. And that's collapsing. This is coming up. One does not, blogging had nothing to do with the decline of American newspaper companies. Moving from family-owned empires to publicly traded companies had more to do with it than the invention of the blog. But there are all these things happening simultaneously. There is rapid motion, there is confusion, there is conflict, all good things for writers, all good things. You went to Columbia, you know that. It isn't if it bleeds, it leads, but if it bleeds, it's much, if you get in your car and you get to work and nothing happens, there's no news. But if an event happens that either delays you or causes tragedy, that is news, and more people care than you got to work safely today. Mm. So we as an animal have been interested in what's new and what the stories are since the cave, and if you look at any cave-dwelling hieroglyphics, you know that we've always covered the same kind of stuff from the same kind of angle. But we're in a time where the tools are changing dramatically. The institutions are changing dramatically. And in due time, it'll all sort out. It'll probably even get boring. Not so quite yet. It's all we have done is get the world to understand that everything ain't what it used to be. The best practices of yesterday are not so hot anymore. And that you can no longer send messages out, whether you're a government or, except maybe in a few bad countries, or a business, and expect them to be implanted into the foreheads of people who will then robotically open their purses and shovel money at you. This is all done. And that doesn't mean business is done. And, you know, very recently I got called anti-business publicly, and that's absolutely false. I believe social media is good for business, and I believe social media is good for journalism. But it hasn't sorted its way out yet. It is still going through the vetting process, and that's going to take some time.
I totally agree with you, and I wish we could talk longer, but we've already gone a little bit over, and I want to respect your time. Shel Israel, author of Twitterville. If you haven't gone out and bought it, please, please do, because it's a really great book, and I reread it before we chatted, and it definitely holds up given that things change minute to minute. So we'll be looking for your next book, Shel, and I hope you'll give us a heads up and we can chat with you beforehand.
I sure will. Thank you, Janet. I had a lot of fun. The hour went by very, very quickly.
All right. Thanks so much, Shel. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
So I want to thank again Shel Israel for being a guest here on the A-List, and thank you for tuning into the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. We hope you enjoyed the program. If so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to tune in 1 week from today when my featured guest is yet another writer, and that is Seth Godin. He defines himself as a writer, speaker, and agent of change. He has a new book out soon, actually at the end of this month, so we'll get hopefully a preview that we can talk about. So don't miss it. It's 12 noon Pacific, 1 week from today. And please, please do participate in the conversation. Very much want to take your questions to the people we are able to get here on the A-List to chat with. You can tweet in your questions to my Twitter account, which is Jennifer. It's Jennifer with an E-D at the end. And as always, you can keep up with the latest on this show and much, much more at jenniferlindsay.com. And I want to wish everyone a great weekend. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.